Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Catholic Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This channel and episode were created in collaboration with the American Catholic Historical Association, a conference of scholars, archivists, and teachers of Catholic studies. My name is Carlos Ruiz Martinez, and I'm a host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Stephanie Brehm, who is currently an administrator scholar at Northwestern University. Stephanie Brehm is the author of America's Most Famous Catholic, Stephen Colbert and American Religion in the 21st Century, published by Fordham University Press in 2019. In this book, Stephanie Brehm provides a digital ethnography and rhetorical analysis of Stephen Colbert and his character from 2005 to 2014, and examines the intersection between lived religion and mass media, especially how Catholicism shapes Colbert's life and how Colbert, the character, shapes Catholicism. Stephanie, welcome to New Books in Catholic Studies.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Of course. And to get us started, and before we dive into your wonderful book, can you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Definitely. Thank you so much. So when I think about, like, why am I in religious studies, right? There's two real reasons why. The first is my academic background, right? So I went to Florida State University for my undergrad. And at the time, I didn't know it was, like, one of the best universities in the States for religious studies. I worked with Amanda Porterfield and Amy Kohlinger and Martin Kafka, and they were really formative in shaping my interest in American religion. I then went and got a master's at Miami of Ohio in comparative religion, and I worked with Peter Williams and the anthropologist James Biello. And then I got my PhD at Northwestern, working with Bob Orsi and Sarah McFarland Taylor. So my academic lineage really shaped how I understand religion and mass media and pop culture and American religious life. But then there's another side, right? And so, like all humans, I have a personal life, and I come from a multi-faith family. My mom is Catholic. My dad, my sister, and I are Jewish. So I grew up in this interfaith web, right? My parents were heavily involved in both of their religious lives. So, you know, my mom was part of Newman Parish in college. She was part of, we always went to church. She would go every week, and we would go more like once every 2 months, you know. And she also accompanied my dad and my sister and I to synagogue. So coming from this interfaith family, you know, one way that we dealt with any of the tensions that arose was in finding the common ground and also finding common funny themes, right? Both my parents are from New England and New York, so, like, there's a lot of more similarities than differences when you've got an Italian-German Catholic woman and an Eastern European Jewish guy. So that's my religious studies background, and I'm currently working in the graduate school at Northwestern. I'm an administrator there and an instructor in the Master's in Higher Education program and an associate chair at the Women's Residential College at Northwestern. So I really have a great administrator scholar life. I like the little hyphen there because I get to use my organizational logistics skills and still be part of the academic community.
Great. And turning a bit to your book, how did you arrive at this particular project? And so in other words, how did you come to be interested in media and religion and Stephen Colbert and Catholicism in particular?
Right. Well, I started this as an undergrad project. My undergrad thesis was on Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. It was 2009, so at the time they were really big, both on Comedy Central, and just comparing their and contrasting their Jewish and Catholic identities and how that influenced their humor. So I went to Amanda Porterfield at Florida State and said, "Hi, I want to do an independent study with you on religion and humor." And she's like, "I think we have some Mark Twain in the library." And I was like, "Mark Twain? Like, are you serious? That's as up to date as we've got." So it really sparked my interest. And then when I went and worked with Peter Williams at Miami of Ohio, I got more involved in and in thinking about entertainment writ large, right? What a colleague called the fluff, right? But I really feel that this fluff, the things that popular culture shapes so much of our current existence, and it really deserved to be front and center of how people understand and create their religious identities, and also how they contrast themselves with others. It's really, you know, the mediated world is where we live, especially in the digital age, right? It's how we encounter the world around us. So as I was thinking about that, I came to Northwestern and said, okay, I've got these two projects. I can keep working on this like evangetainment thing, or I can, you know, I've been thinking about religion and humor. And Bob and Sarah were just like, well, no one's written on religion and humor, really. Why don't you dive into that, right? Like there'd been, you know, David Feltmate is great. He works on religion and comic books or comics like The Simpsons. And there were other people that had written more about the cathartic aspects of humor. But I was really like, no, I want us to think about this as the role comedy is playing in shaping identity and presenting your identity.
Awesome. And one of the things that I, one of the fascinating things about your book is there's this dynamic between Stephen Colbert's personal Catholicism and the Catholicism of his character in the Colbert Report. And there's sort of a boundary between reality and comic representation that is complex. Can you elaborate on that dynamic a little bit?
Definitely. Well, you know, I would go in and people would say, is he really Catholic, like in real life? And I was like, but all the world is a stage. It's all performance, right? And so having to parse that out, there was this aspect of doublespeak that the persona really allowed Colbert to embrace that that I think was really important at the time to try and see where the boundaries between at the, you know, especially politically, liberal and conservative boundaries and how they were blended or not as stark as we would think they are, right? And this boundary is, you're right, it is complex. It's also really, really hard to study a person whose main character is also named that person. I was using scare quotes for a while in my dissertation, and then when I was transitioning into the book, they're like, oh my God, we can't do scare quotes are going to just freak people out. So I came up with the idea of doing all caps but small print, as if, because Colbert, the character, is really yelling at you all the time, and like all caps is really representative of yelling at you. But it was really hard to find the moments where it would be a different person. So I'd have to be watching for these embodied actions, right? Like, how do I know if he's really laughing or if the character is laughing? How do I know? And, you know, at some point I can't. I can only make assumptions based on hours of watching this man, right? But that's where the performance aspect comes in, and the assumption that if he is being perceived by others, there is some way of performance. And so it's just deciphering when he's putting on one type of performance or another.
Great. And so Colbert is a, you know, according to himself, America's most famous Catholic, but he's also a part of a long lineage of influential Catholic public figures in American mass media. You know, I think Fulton Sheen, for example. Can you tell us a little bit of the history of that lineage of, you know, Catholic public figures in mass media? And then can you also explain, how is Colbert innovative, or what does he bring to the table that is different from that lineage?
That's a great question. And, you know, when I talk about Catholics and media, the thing that comes to mind, right, Fulton Sheen, and I put him also in context with Father Charles Coughlin, right? These often bombastic and larger-than-life figures who are authoritative, right? That's the image that I so often think of with, you know, mid-20th century Catholic entertainers, is that they are presenting an authority. They're presenting a way of life, but also they are in charge, right? They're also all men. So Colbert is not innovative in that way. But where Colbert differs in that authority is that Colbert is a lay Catholic. And so Colbert, when he gives his guests, who are Catholic priests, space and room to present their ideas, he's still deferring to Catholic clerical authority, right? Because he's not embodying that himself. So I think that's where Colbert is innovative. But I also think he's in a long line of these authoritative figures who are Catholic, and that, you know, the ties to a known hierarchy are part of what's important in American religious life, right? Like, it's a Catholic institutions, when you think of religion in the U.S., a lot of people, their first images that come to mind are priests and churches, right? Because those are other, but they are religion, right? They are squarely sacred. And so Colbert is innovating by being a Catholic authority, right? But removed from that inherent sacrality of the clerical look and clerical persona.
And so related to this notion of authority, right, and what Colbert contributes, you think in your third chapter, you think about Colbert as a catechist, which I think is really, really fascinating and interesting to think about. Can you, for the non-specialist, can you sort of define catechist and then explain how Colbert plays into this role?
Right. Well, for my book, a catechist is someone who teaches about Catholicism, whether to Catholics or to non-Catholics. And so usually it's to Catholics, right? Someone is teaching them about their own religion or about the catechism. And I'm expanding it and saying that Colbert is a catechist to his audiences, right? Many of whom are not Catholic. And I think Colbert is a catechist because he knows so much about his religion. It's embedded in his existence, and it comes out in his language. It comes out in his phrasing, but also like when he makes connections to things, sometimes Catholicism is part of that. He's a catechist because he's imbuing his existence with Catholic themes. And so it's kind of notable, right, that a lay Catholic entertainer acts as catechist for Catholics and non-Catholics alike, right? He's teaching people about Catholicism. He has this great, great segment called The Catholic Bender, where he gave up Catholicism for Lent, as one does, but then, you know, was a bad Catholic in that he couldn't fully give up Catholicism for Lent, and he went on a quote-unquote Catholic bender, right? And he's talking about all of the trappings, all of the materiality of Catholicism, and he's explaining these things, and, you know, for insiders, for Catholics, the jokes make a lot of sense. For outsiders, they still make sense because you're learning from Colbert what these items are. And I think that even though his version of Catholicism and his version of the catechist is not the official or authorized Catholicism, his status as this self-identified Catholic and this media catechist really shows that he has the type of authority that allows him to mock aspects of Catholicism in a familial, like, teasing way, because he's part of the fold, right? He's not saying, you Catholics, I am mocking you. He's saying, we Catholics, I am mocking us.
Thank you. Now I want to step back and think about religion and comedy more broadly for a bit. So in chapter four, you mentioned that scholars and popular audiences don't often think about how religious identity intersects with comedy and humor. And you mentioned that earlier in our conversation, right, that when you were bringing up to your mentors at different academic levels, there's not a lot written. And when we do see religion and comedy and humor being treated, it's usually Judaism as a stand-in, right, for religion more broadly. And so I'm curious as to what you learned about humor and Catholicism throughout the course of your research and writing.
Yeah, that's a great question, right? Because, you know, I didn't want, when I told people I was studying religion and comedy, Judaism came up, and I'm Jewish, right? So the expectation was, oh, I'm studying, you know, myself. And that's just not how I wanted to embrace this understanding, right? I wanted to look at the people we don't think of as religious comedians. And I learned that white male Catholics really base their identity in their comedy as much as others do, as much as Jewish comics and Black comics, Latino comics. These identity politics, right? We just don't, it's part of this white supremacy, right? We don't see it as them basing it in their white Catholic identity, but in reality, they are. I didn't fully have a language for this in my book that I, you know, of course, with all books, you wish you could go back and rewrite whole chapters. But I really think that, like, the white male Catholicism of George Carlin and Stephen Colbert and Jim Gaffigan, right, it's particular in that they are using their Catholicism as either a way to distance themselves, like show their identity as different than it was in the past, or embrace aspects of their identity. But it's really interesting that, like, they're railing against the man, the hierarchy, but the man is also themselves too, right? So it's a way for them to try and be in every person, right? And their Catholic comedy, right? It didn't matter that they were Catholic in the 60s, 70s to now, right? Because Catholicism was so heavily embedded already in the white American experience, that it wasn't seen as other in the same way that Judaism was and potentially still is, that African-American comedy is, that Latinx comedy is, right? The white male Catholicism has become the norm, right? For late night hosts, when I was writing this, you know, including Larry Wilmore, right, a Black Catholic, there were, I think, 7 out of the 9 late night hosts were Catholic or had grown up Catholic. Right? It's like Supreme Court. All of a sudden, everybody's Catholic on it.
So I'm thinking, you say, so you use the term Colbert Catholicism, right? Also in your book. What is Colbert Catholicism, and how does this this idea of Colbert Catholicism should push our understanding of Catholicism in the United States, or maybe even globally, right? Catholicism is a sort of global a church, right? And in some ways, this is an American Catholic story, but maybe there's a way to think about it globally as well.
Yeah, I wish that I had been able to spend more time thinking globally about it, right? But, you know, American religious history being what it is, we seem to place ourselves within often the continental United States, you know, from 1620s to now. And so when I define Colbert Catholicism, I put Colbert's theological musings in context with his humor, right? So Colbert Catholicism is both an act of using humor to discuss joy, sorrow, pain, all of the aspects, you know, what one could call religious sentiments. And also, it's a type of Catholicism that sees humor as beneficial to one's faith. So that, if I had to, like, summarize what I describe as Colbert's Catholicism, that's it, right? Humor is integral to how he understands his religion. He articulates and embodies and performs his lay religiosity, right, by taking and choosing parts of Catholicism, right? Catholicism is not one thing. It has never been, regardless of, you know, there's institutional, there's lay, there's everything in between. And so Colbert embodies that by, with his persona, right, and by being a real person as well, the dual performances mean that we can see how he picks and chooses things. We are seeing the embodiment of that choice, which some could argue would be an American aspect. But I think global Catholicism is also doing that picking and choosing, right? What Greeley called the cafeteria Catholicism, I think that has A, always been part of it. You know, we keep thinking it's new. It's not that new, right? But who gets to do the selecting is new, right? The individual authority to choose which aspects you want to include or not include is a relatively new, and the historians in the room are going to be upset that I said that, relatively new phenomenon. And I think Colbert epitomizes that with his personae, right? By having multiple personalities that we get to see and interact with. So that's where I think the Colbert Catholicism comes in. He is both picking and choosing, but he's doing so with humor as beneficial, not antithetical to his religiosity. And then Colbert's theology itself combines suffering and joy, right? So if we're looking at Colbert Catholicism, yes, humor is beneficial, but it's also this multiplicity of suffering and joy. And he, you know, his father and brothers died when he was young. And so working through some of that trauma, he talks about in interviews how he's grateful for suffering so he can understand joy. And so you're seeing sort of the multifaceted aspects of his Catholicism. It's not just on surface funny, right? There are layers to the comedy that come with it.
Thank you. And as you mentioned, you know, Catholicism is not one thing, right? There are lay Catholics don't do exactly, you know, what the church says, right? And so you see this with Colbert. Even though Colbert is a Catholic, he's also been quite critical of the institutional Catholic Church through his comedy. And this has led to tensions, right? He's sort of touched on some of the, you know, controversial points within American and global Catholicism. Can you tell us a little bit about some of his more poignant comedic critiques of the Catholic Church and some of the big tensions that he's touched upon?
Yeah, and actually, you know what? I expected Colbert to be more critical of the, you know, official institutional Catholic Church than he was. And people, you know, I think when they look back on the Colbert Report, they read that into what happened because he was so critical of political institutions. They were like, oh, but he was also critiquing the Catholic Church. Well, kind of, but he was okay with these like low stake jokes, right? Like Pope Benedict has funny red Prada shoes, right? Like, ooh, materialism in the Catholic Church. Like this is new and not like thousands of years old. Mm-hmm. But where I found it most interesting were the clerical sex abuse scandals, right? Because he only had one major segment on the Colbert Report devoted to the sexual abuse scandal, right? Whereas gay marriage, for example, had like 50 separate segments. And I think that reason, like birth control and abortion and gay marriage also involved non-Catholic conservative Christian groups. And so he was able to say, engage, like it didn't have to touch his personal, the non-persona Catholicism as much, right? But when it got to the clerical sex abuse, that is a Catholic issue, right? I mean, not sex abuse is not totally a Catholic issue. The clerical sex abuse crisis is a solely Catholic issue. And Colbert's response, right, he was on the air from 2005 to 2014, right? In 2011, so like halfway through his tenure there is when he had this one segment that was really, it wasn't like tearing down the Catholic Church. It was sort of bland and mundane. It wasn't the funniest thing he's ever done, right? And so I think it was harder for him to discuss these issues without first having a buy your leave from aspects of the Catholic institution, right? He waited until the Council of Bishops discussed the issue. It wasn't when other comedians and pundits were doing it, right? The segment came up in 2011 because the Council of Bishops talked about it. It really exemplifies how reluctant Colbert was when confronting aspects of the church's authority. You know, he would let Father Jim Phillips speak, Father Jim Martin speak for the church, but it wasn't, you know, Colbert wouldn't really confront a lot of those critical things as hard-hitting as non-Catholic or people who consider themselves ex-Catholic did.
And so in chapter six, you discuss Stephen Colbert's role in the culture wars. And, you know, this term culture wars is a term that we almost take for granted today, right? You hear it, you know, in the news and, in you know, television shows and so on. But you use it in a, you do a good job of actually being specific with it and saying, like, this is what the culture wars are, how I'm employing them. Can you tell us first, what are the culture wars? And then what do you see Colbert's role in them? Like, what is his role as a public figure?
Yeah, I mean, so it's really, the culture wars has been taken and, you know, scholarship wants to erase these binaries of left and right and liberal conservative in the culture wars. But the mythic quality of this, you know, conservative right and progressive left and liberal left are really important. Like, the mythic quality remains, whether or not it's quote unquote true, right? That's the image that is mediated to all of us, either through the media or through our understanding and the boundaries we're creating around ourselves in the US, both politically and culturally. And, you know, the 2016 presidential election really illustrated that those sentiments are more than myth, right? They are deeply embedded in the U.S.'s culture. And so the culture wars is like this stereotype that I've embraced, right? Because it's a stereotype that Colbert embraces. And he embraces it because he is mimicking, you know, people like Bill O'Reilly on Fox News, who proliferated these culture wars. And so when I think about what the culture wars are, yes, there's a lot of scholarship and academic work that's saying they are more than meets the eye, but the stereotypes remain and their husks are fodder comedically for Colbert at the time to like dig in and personify as a way of doublespeak and to say like, I'm mocking it because it exists in the world right now. And so, yeah, I think Stephen Colbert's role in it has been in part to, I think he desensitized a lot of those who watched his show into thinking that anyone who made similarly bombastic, hyperbolic assertions is funny and not to be taken seriously. And I think that desensitized us in a lot of ways to what we've had in the past 8-9 years, right? These authoritarian leaders who play into the culture wars and really bump up the stereotypes into these monoliths that can't be broken down, even though we know that these are not, that not everyone fits these molds. But because Colbert was able to parody the mold, it became even more entrenched in society. Now, I'm not saying Colbert is totally responsible for Trump, but a little, maybe a little.
I have a bit of a bonus question for you, and it's about your method. Would say that it's you can push back on this, but it would be fair to say that this is, you know, combines rhetorical analysis and digital media ethnography. And I want to talk about that digital media ethnography. Can you describe a little bit about what that looks like? And perhaps some of the challenges of this particular method, right? I think especially over the past almost 2 years now, right, with COVID, ethnographers have really turned to digital method and sort of finding ways to do ethnography that isn't just close contact with people all the time, right? And you ahead of the curve with this, right? Because your book was published right before the pandemic. So yeah, I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about that method.
Well, it was accidental. I planned to do a production ethnography of the Colbert Report, but the jerk canceled his show like a month after I wrote my prospectus. So my plan was to be in New York for like all of 2015. And the jerk canceled his show December 2014. So I was able to attend a couple of shows and do some minimal in-person ethnography. And that was really helpful for me to like get a grounding in what was going on. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that those producing the show, right, I knew I couldn't do reception studies. That is not my forte. That is for sociologists and media scholars. Like, I don't play that game. And I also knew that, like, I was well-versed in how to study media because of the work I had done in other realms, right? And so digital ethnography, for me, is, you know, if ethnography is figuring, like going, walking into the world making of others, digital ethnography is the same thing. You're just doing it online, right? Like you are critically engaging with the websites, right? Like why are they choosing this color and why would they do this and what's happening there? And then you're engaging with the social media or the Reddit or the groups that are critical, or, you know, you're looking at all the conversations that are going on. It's like immersing yourself in these conversations. And yes, they are often anonymized and you're not getting, you know, the physicality of it. I wouldn't say you do material studies in a digital context, right? That might be really hard. But for doing things where you're asking people what they think and what they feel, it's actually a really great way to engage with people, right? Because people are living their lives in digital contexts. And they're often, when anonymous, more open to saying things. So I found when I was studying the hashtag cancel Colbert thing that happened in mid-2014, you know, right at the end of his show, it was about, it was an offensive tweet about Asian Americans, but it was taken out of context. And there was like a whole hashtag cancel Colbert thing. And that was really interesting to dive into that conflict in a digital realm, right? I didn't feel endangered going in there, right? Because I'm also anonymous. I'm also able to protect what's going on. And there are many others who do it much better than I do. I am much more of a rhetorical analysis scholar who is using digital ethnography methods to gain access. But I wouldn't necessarily call myself solely a digital ethnographer because, you know, I'm not just studying digital spaces. I'm also studying journalistic spaces, which are much more produced, right? So I'm thinking about that production. But for scholars who are, you know, the pandemic has really shown how much there can be done in these digital spaces and how connected we are globally through the internet and these amazing technologies. I don't think it reduces anything religiously. I think we've seen by the number of Zoom masses, right, and the number of online services that religion is happening. And even when we're separated, right, it doesn't mean that it's any less important to look at.
Absolutely. And I thank you for talking to us about your book. And I have one final question. Are there any projects that you are working on now? Did any lingering questions remain from, you know, America's Most Famous Catholic that you're pursuing now? Or maybe, you know, have you taken on a new direction in your research interests?
Well, and this is open for anybody who wants to study it. Please take this idea and run with it. You know, I wish that I had had more time to spend on Colbert's interactions with other religions. Like he had this atone phone where a famous Jew would have to call him on Yom Kippur to ask forgiveness from Colbert. Right? Like, oh man, I wish I had had space and time to really dive into that. And, you know, now with Anthea Butler's work and, you know, Kristen Cobes-Dumez's work, I wish I had been able to think more with the white supremacy narratives that are coming to light. I think Colbert would have played into that in ways that I wasn't able to articulate at the time. But research is not a huge part of my career right now. I'm an administrator, I'm an instructor, and I am a mentor. And so I get to do the parts I really like. I actually am not, you know, this might be verboten, but I got into this for teaching, not as much for research. And so Although at the moment, my friend Maya Reese, who was a colleague of mine at Miami and Northwestern, we're thinking about Goop, Gwyneth Paltrow's company, and wellness culture in American religious history and cultural context right now. I enjoy co-writing with her and with others. Like, I enjoy that facilitating research kind of engagement. So that's where my head's at right now.
Awesome. Thank you, Stephanie. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And, you know, on behalf of the ACHA and the New Books Network, thank you for chatting with us.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful.